most original and creative talent in our business, would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles again, come to call for another visit.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
And we're in Philadelphia this next time?
Yep. So he's moving into the last leg of the tryouts. Philadelphia gets extended a week, so he'll be here 2 weeks other than the other places he's been a week. But as we know, he's a little bit more excited because he's pretty sure it's going to go to Broadway now. So this is the last stop.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed our unusual cold open there as we immediately went into talking about the show. This is Buck Benny speaking. I'm with Kathy Fuller-Seeley and Vincent Longo and Terry Phillips. And we are just delighted to bring Orson with you. And we're so excited about it. We get started sometimes before we even get the ball rolling. But Orson is back. Last week he wasn't on. This week he is on. And just a fun episode with Orson telling us all about what's going on with his production, and Vincent will bring us up to speed on that. So Vincent, in our ongoing tale of his production issues, he says at the beginning of this that, oh, it's going like so much better now. And it makes it sound like he's got the kinks worked out and they're ready to roll. But I have a feeling Vincent will tell us otherwise. What do you think, Vincent?
Well, no, you know, Daryl, things are getting a little bit better, and I'm not going to just totally trash on Orson's excitement here. They're in Philadelphia now, as I mentioned. The script is a lot lighter. There are scenes completely gone. It's about 45 minutes shorter now, and it was about 3.5 hours before. So, you know, as far as Broadway musicals go, 2 hours, 45 minutes, that's not super long. So he's happy about that. Critics, you know, now that he's playing Dick Fix with Alan Reed's absence, he is again getting good press, partly for the play, but also largely for his boy wonder, the myth of Orson Welles. He can do it all. He's a producer, a director, a writer, an actor, a radio commentator, and all this stuff. So he's pretty sure, though, that Around the World is going to make it to Broadway. As he mentions in this episode, the last time he was in Philadelphia with a play, which was his adaptation of several of Shakespeare's histories. It didn't make it. Which Five Kings, which sort of becomes Chimes at Midnight, his later film, but they didn't make it. That was a complete disaster. That's a long story for another day. But so he's, in some ways he thinks, I should be feeling bad. This marks my disaster, but he's pretty sure all signs are pointing to this going through. But yeah, what's weird about this episode is that he begins by like 5 minutes of talking about just Around the World and then the Algonquin Hotel. I don't know what people made of that, but at first I thought this was going to be a show where clearly he was underprepared, and I think he probably was, but he pulls it together after the 5 minutes. But the first 5 minutes I thought were like, wow, he's not going anywhere. We're back to the random stories.
All right. Terry, what do you want to chat about for this episode?
Well, speaking of the Algonquin Hotel, I'm glad that I got to have a drink in their bar once.
Nice.
But I never met, you know, the luminaries of the Round Table. They were a little before my time.
I'm at the cat.
in this episode, Orson Welles once again is an advocate for what would come to be known as the civil rights movement, voter registration in Alabama, and spent some significant time talking about the Ku Klux Klan and the white supremacy phenomenon. He had an interesting turn on the term segregation at the end, which I really appreciated. And it is, once again, Orson Welles being not only a great showman, an eloquent performer, but a passionate and brave advocate for doing the right thing, for getting America to do the right thing. And here we are, what, 64 75 years later. And yes, of course, some things have changed, but we're still fighting over the same issues, still struggling for people to get the basic right to vote. And there was Orson Welles telling us, you know, pay attention to this. This is important. People deserve to be treated as equals and decently. And
well, again, this Welles at his best. Is so amazing in that you think about it, 75 years before this episode aired, they were starting to look at fighting to free to end slavery and the whole Civil War was being at least thought about at that time. And then the point of this program is he talks about it. And then now we're still fighting for folks to maintain their rights to vote. We're still having issues with treating people fairly and the whole thing, and with the Black Lives Matter movement and everything else going on, George Floyd, and certainly recently his case dealing with that in the last few weeks. It's just amazing how it continues on. And I think it would have been interesting to see if Orson would think that this was going to be a continuing thing or whether he thought it was going to be dealt with by now. But I don't know. I mean, it is something that they dealt with for years and years and years before that. And so I wouldn't be surprised if he would have said, I hope it's over, but I don't know, you know.
I was going to say it would be interesting to hear what Orson Welles had to say today. But in a way, I think we have heard what he had to say in this episode.
Well, like I said about other episodes, including this one, you wouldn't have to change a whole lot of it, and it can kind of apply to today.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Kathy.
I was so struck when he was talking about the letter he read, that the a perfect thing for radio, because I really didn't know it was about African Americans at the beginning. It was because he talked about people wearing their service uniforms or the and so. I love the fact that the way he described the letter, read the letter, it was sort of universal, of returning service people marching together. And it was so hopeful, thinking that hooray, this could be accomplished. And there was that moment of hope, from what I understand, in the African American community, that having done all this service in the military and for the country during the war, that there was going to be that voting rights would be taken care of, that equality would be moving forward rapidly. In Hollywood, connected to Jack Benny, Eddie Anderson was getting starred in some prominent roles in quite a number of pictures that had integrated casts. And there was so much, as I said, a hope that this would be a new day. And by 1946, but it was also then sort of coming up again and again against a backlash. In Eddie Anderson's case, the movie he was in, Brewster's Millions, if that was the title of it this time, got banned in Memphis by the police film censor. Said there's too much integration, too much friendliness between the races. And that horrible banning made the Hollywood studios back down suddenly and stop making, removing African-Americans from most high dollar Hollywood films. So, as I said, I love that the letter was expressing sort of hope and change. But we're going to see it's a time in which there's a very sad, very terrific backlash that's going to then lead to the next sort of 15 years of civil rights protests. So I love the hope and the unique kind of radio way in which that was done. If I could add one more thing, it's that I'm not sure how Orson's then talk about being a child and wearing a hood as a part of a Halloween ritual. I'm not sure how that would work in today's sort of cancel culture or wokeness. Mm-hmm. I don't know if people hearing that would not understand his subtlety, but So I found that very intriguing, but it's like, I'm not sure he would take that exact tack today, because I think the tactic makes him appear complicit as a small innocent child running around wearing hoods, instead of maybe today he would go straight for the condemnation. Yeah. But as I said, that was just a thought in listening to it.
Well, yeah, it was a, that was a big beauty analogy. Of the past. I mean, they could actually have nuance. Nuance doesn't exist today. So,
but Vince, you were saying, hey, Vincent, it was a little. I found that unexpected. It was like,
He even acknowledged that it was a shaky analogy at one point. I think Dale, I mean, you guys are totally right. There's nuance to this, but even he mentions at one point where he says, to paraphrase something like, you might think I'm calling them the thinking of small children, and that's not what I'm doing. But that's he sort of is, but he has to sort of claim like, no, I'm sort of condemning them, but in a very nuanced way. But it does come off as this constant comparison between this sort of childlike thought. I mean, he has that in other places, and it's sort of a precursor to his what he'll do with Isaac Woodard later. There's two things I think that are key to mention here that will come up later. The first is this connection between white supremacy and the KKK to fascism and Nazism in particular. He calls them the KKK pagan Nazis. Mm-hmm. And he will compare them, or he compares them here and he does elsewhere, to primitive stereotypes, the voodoo, the things like that. This is something he constantly refers to. And actually the child analogy, although imperfect, works here, because he's essentially saying this is a primitive thought. Mm-hmm. White supremacy is primitive ideology at its base. The other thing though he does, I think, which is really beautifully evoked in this letter, is the mention of the uniforms and these African-Americans wearing military uniforms. Yeah. This will come up in the Isaac Woodard as well, because he wears them when he was beaten. And, you know, there was nothing more repugnant to a white supremacist in the South than an African-American wearing a military uniform, because, you know, white supremacy is built on a hierarchy. And suddenly the uniform reminds them as a constant reminder of patriotism, of, you know, the idea that the people who serve our country are the best and brightest. And to see an African-American in that really sort of would hurt that idea of this hierarchy. And so we can see these tensions boiling that are going to come up later in Wells's work, happening right here in this letter.
Yep.
Vincent, I know these were scripted commentaries, but would you not agree that this one sort of sounded like Wells was thinking out loud as he was speaking to us?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I mentioned in my notes here that he had a rare moment where he said, you know, for most people, for myself, definitely, that would never stick out to me, but it really stuck out for me for Wells. And I thought, okay, he clearly didn't remember, or was like reading the letter and realized she wanted to be anonymous. He also chastised her for wanting to be anonymous. He's never done that in a letter.
Right. Right.
And I thought, okay, I don't know if he just thought like, no, you can't be anonymous with this, because this is breeding this idea that we should, you know, be ashamed of the idea of equality. And so if he's not totally unscripting, I mean, he's playing it loose, much looser than he has, you know, again, in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. And I don't know if it was a technique, you know, an actor's technique of sounding spontaneous, or if he really giving us a glimpse of his thinking process.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, given how busy he was, you can sort of imagine that, but you're absolutely right, Terry. You can never underestimate Orison's thinking 20 steps ahead at the same time to make it as performative as possible. So
yeah, well, to tie this into another podcast I've been doing, we've been doing the Falcon and Winter Soldier that we've been talking about, which is the Disney Marvel superhero thing, and it really ties into a lot of this. Even the time frame it ties in. They introduce a black man who they were originally, if you know the story of Captain America, basically they injected him with this super serum that made him into a super soldier. Well, you're not going to experiment on a whole bunch of white people, so they experimented on black people first, or during that time frame, And it worked with this black man. And so they had him go do missions in World War II and things for them and so forth. And then after they didn't need him anymore, he certainly couldn't be the emblem of America or anything. So they had to give it to a white guy that had blonde hair to become Captain America. And he talks about the fact that they put him in jail for many years because of it. And they just totally, and they tie it in with the experimentation done on blacks and throughout history. And it's just interesting to hear how fiction, they try and tie it in, and it ties in so well to what we're talking about right now. So I thought that was interesting. The other piece is Kathy mentioned Brewster's Millions. And I still think that's one of the single worst casting decisions anyone's ever made, when they didn't have Jack Benny play Brewster in Brewster's Millions and they had Eddie Rochester Anderson playing in the movie. I just think it would, with his character having to spend all that money, so it would have played in so many ways that I think it still might be a classic. I mean, still Brewster's Millions is kind of a classic now, but I think it would even be more of a classic had they actually featured Jack Benny in the story. They did do it sometimes in radio with Jack in the part, but
didn't he get hit on the head by some cans of?
Yes.
And there was a radio episode where he was being generous.
To he was being cans right. of
because he could get he made Rochester purchase cans at the grocery store that had lost their labels as yes. a cans of.
So, that's right. So. Well, and then he the writers wanted to extend that for a number of weeks. But after, I think, 2 weeks, they were like, this is way harder to write than him being stingy and make it funny. So we're going to switch back and have him hit with another can or something. And so he went back the other way very quickly, because I think they were thinking it was going to be like a 6 week thing that they did. And I think they ended up doing it in two. So anyway, but I hope you all enjoy this, Orson. Do we have anything else to add on anything on this? Do we cover it pretty well? I think. All right. Well, a really unique episode, really a wonderful episode. And I think his first real deep dive into the Ku Klux Klan in these shows. So he keeps on bringing us new things. Like we were saying, it kind of works. It kind of doesn't work. I mean, his talk about the Klan, I think, does work. His talk when he talks about himself as a child, I think... what takes away from it. It doesn't help. It doesn't make it better. It makes it worse in some ways. So, but not everything's going to work. And with Orson, most things do, but not everything. So, and we'll see if this whole show that he's putting on eventually works. Only Vincent knows. We'll all find out.
It's marvelous. Vincent, I could wait, save the question for afterward. But what's happened to the music in all of this? Cole Porter wrote the score, right? Why is not the famous Cole Porter coming out? Are these lousy songs?
Not to go too long, we'll talk more about Cole Porter.
You're good.
But a lot of historians mention, music historians mention, that this is Cole Porter's sort of worst period of his career. He's on a downward trajectory. He goes back up later. I don't know his body
gets away from Morrison,
well. But essentially, yeah, he gets away from Morrison. It gets better. But no, there was other musicals where he was sort of going down. His reputation was still high, mm-hmm. certainly. But the reviews of the songs in Around the World are mixed. They were all over the place. Yeah. Critics liked some of them, but they didn't ever agreed on which ones.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a mixed bag from Cole Porter, who was an investor in the show. So he wasn't like, pardon the pun, but he wasn't like not invested, but they're just sort of lukewarm, and his name is drawing more than the music itself.
Okay. Thank you. Always interesting, guys. Thanks. Always interesting conversation. Love it. Love it. So enjoy the show, and we'll see you guys next time.
Hello, this is Orson Welles speaking. Last week, I missed the broadcast. It pleases me to imagine that you didn't miss the broadcast and that you missed me. If so, may I interest you, please, in my assurances that I'm all well again and that all's well with the Mercury again. The Mercury Theater's new musical Around the World, which has been playing such havoc with my health, is in better shape than I am, ladies and gentlemen. And another week, we move to Broadway. Just now we're in Philadelphia and doing very nicely, thank you, as to business. And this cheers us up quite some because another big, elaborate Mercury production got into this city on another spring, never went on to New York at all. Five Kings, that was, and plenty of years ago that was, too. Five Kings was mostly an omnibus Henry IV, parts 1 and 2 by Mr. Shakespeare, and his Henry V. Well, as you know, Mr. Laurence Olivier's movie, Henry V, is the movie news of the month, and his Henry IV, by the Old Vic Producing Company, playing in New York, is the theater news of the week, maybe of the year. I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I hope to before Ralph Richardson, who's Falstaff, and the rest of those fine actors go back to England, before I have to pack my bags and start west for a summer in Hollywood. Well, aren't I the chatty one this morning? Last week this time, I wasn't so blithe, believe me. Motoring down from New Haven, I checked in at the Algonquin, a hotel which, as far as I was concerned last week, turned out to be just on the corner of 44th Street and a nervous breakdown. I just squeaked around that corner by the artful dodge of not going to work and passed a fretful 48 hours between the sheets thinking about this show and the other one, the stage show, and the... Both of them, of course, weren't going on. Excuse me while I find my place. Really, I don't know why the show must go on. We always say the show must go on, you know. Nobody ever misses any show except the people who put it on. That's what I told myself last weekend, that lost last weekend. But believe me, it was cold comfort in a darkened hotel room. The last time I stopped at the Algonquin was that black time when that other earlier show of ours opened in Philadelphia and was getting ready to close there. And I'd come to New York for another broadcast and come down with a high fever. And this fairly scarifying coincidence contributed no little to my gloomy Sunday 7 days ago. The brightening picture for around the world, therefore, is what makes me sound so little like your political commentator and so much like somebody's idiot son writing a letter home. The Algonquin, since we're launched on this spurt of reminiscence and chit-chat, is a fine hotel as well as a famous one. Books are written in it and about it. This mostly, I suppose, because Frank Case, who owns the institution, makes such a good job of running it. And also perhaps because Frank reads a little himself and writes quite a lot. Of course, the celebrated Round Table is no more. Heywood Broun and Alec Wolcott are no longer with us. But folks who do things worth mentioning and say things worth repeating still make a habit of lunch at Mr. Case's tavern, and I'm happy to report that the popovers are as buoyant and gorgeous as of yore. I can't leave off talking about the Algonquin without telling you one of my favorite Algonquin stories. It concerns another of the Algonquin stalwarts, another one who's checked out for good, along with Jack Barrymore and Alec and Heywood. I mean, Robert Benchley. Bob used to come in for six-day weekends on 44th Street. This was a custom of years standing, and it was noted by the hotel staff through the years that his luggage was invariably heavier on departure than upon arrival. With a hotel man's philosophic tolerance of petty larceny, nothing was said regarding this. And then it came to pass that after much urging, Frank Case consented to be Benchley's house guest for a night or two in those outer suburbs where the Benchley family kept official residence. Bob showed his hotel proprietor, house guest and friend, proudly to the guest room and to a practical joke of very long preparation. Not only the linen, the towels and blankets, the occasional oddments like ashtrays, but also the rugs, the curtains, and even small articles of furniture were all plainly marked Hotel Algonquin. Well, it's been too long now since we've read letters from any of you, and I've been getting a lot of them, and they've been wonderful. As you know, we have a custom of reading your letters and a custom of thanking you for the letters we use by sending you a radio, a very fine table model. This week's letter, if I only get to one, gets a radio for a lady who wants to be anonymous and who writes me as follows. Dear Mr. Wells, one very ordinary day in March 1946, something happened which made it not an ordinary day at all. A group of men formed a little parade of themselves. Tall, strong, determined men they were, yet men in whose eyes could be detected fear. And so, most truthfully, they could be called brave men also. Uniforms bearing the label USA and a little discharge button were the predominant costumes. The others were suits, unmatched trousers and coats and sweaters, but that doesn't matter. Two abreast, they came along through the streets, often calling out to others to join them, and When such efforts were crowned with success and their numbers were swelled, their rigid faces would relax for a moment and their step become lighter. They might even be able to swallow past the tightness in their throats. On they went. People stopped and stared. Groups clustered together. There were expressions of horror, and the view with alarmists began to view most energetically. Likewise, may I most thankfully say, there were those, though apparently much too few in number, whose hearts were filled with pride and whose eyes were filled with tears as they watched that march that exacted a courage equal to that of the valiant 600. Equal, did I say? I beg your pardon. 1,000 pardons, my brave marchers. You knew the reason why, but you did not know what might be the aftermath of that march. Lynchings, jail, mob terror, all were exceedingly possible, yet on they went. Their pilgrimage ended at a huge building over whose entrance is inscribed a touching sentiment having to do with justice to one and all. Police officers appeared and arrested some of these marchers. The charge was using the uniform for political purposes, the uniform being of the USA, the home of the brave. It's supposed to be used only to depart this life. Nevertheless, the others made their way to the office of the registrar. The spokesman inquired if they might register as duly qualified voters of the state of Alabama, USA, the land of the free and the home of the brave. They were duly informed that the office was closing. They'd have to return the following day. And so with depleted ranks and a sense of anticlimax, they did return. And yesterday, a radio announcer informed any who might be listening that for the first time in 70 years, the Democratic primaries of the state of Alabama, USA, the land of the free, etc., was open to Negro citizens of the aforementioned USA. Hail to you, O marchers. To the lady who wrote this letter, which I appreciate having been able to read to you, may I say just this, madam, I respect your desire for anonymity. By the way, she writes me this as a postscript note to Mr. Wells. Please do not reveal my name in connection with this writing, as I do not wish to lose a friend. May I respect your desire for anonymity, madam, but may I also regret it. Secrecy, I think, is a matter for the ballot box, but not for convictions as wholesome as yours. Secrecy, for example, is a special attribute of the Ku Klux Klan, a group of marchers quite different than those you speak of in your letter. Refer you to recent newspapers. I'm sure you see what I mean. Last night, madam, a man in Alabama put his head into a hood. He wrapped himself in a sheet. Then he went and stood on a hill outside of town with a number of his friends and neighbors, all of them with their heads hooded and all of them wrapped in sheets. I don't know exactly what they did up there on the hill. There were some speeches, probably, and maybe some community singing. I don't know how you sing in a hood. And at the climax of the evening's entertainment, there was the burning of a fiery cross. I remember when I was a little boy, I saw one of those crosses raising a glow in the sky, and I remember wishing I could join the fun, thinking that fiery cross was some kind of kid's prank. Somebody explained that the Ku Klux Klan was burning its cross in the field in favor of a thing called white supremacy, and I remember thinking it must be some kind of practical joke. I've since discovered that the notion of white supremacy isn't any sort of joke, and I found out that wherever it's been tried, it certainly hasn't been practical. But the fiery cross looked like lots of fun, and I imagined that this white supremacy thing must be an institution comparable to Halloween. When I saw the hoods and sheets the Ku Kluxers wore, I was sure I was right. Now that I'm a man and the Klan is riding again, I've had some time to think about it, and I'm not sure I was wrong. Now, I'm not suggesting that the gentlemen of the KKK are just a lot of grown-up boys. They aren't burning those crosses to roast marshmallows. I'm just recalling what I felt like in the days when I put my head into a hood. Of course, it was a pillowcase with two holes in it, but the effect's about the same as the man's in Alabama. Well, the purpose was different. I wasn't old enough to vote or old enough to stop somebody else from voting. But there crowds back into recollection the restless mood of frenzy that went with the hood, with the wearing of the sheet. I remember that when we kids were Halloween ghosts, we always kept together, ringing doorbells and dumping out garbage. We worked as a gang. Of course, we wanted our victims to think us the most fearsome hobgoblins. But when one of us found himself alone for even a minute, he was seized with a kind of panic. He was more scared than anybody tried to scare. And there is, I think, a timeless truth in this. One of the most awful experiences in the whole range of terror is to be a lonesome, a solitary spook. Such a spook is like the purple cowl. It is better to see than be one. The Ku Kluxer then, cut off from the company the Hooded Hood, might very well take sudden leave of what senses still remain to him, and there may well have been cases where a prominent local lawyer or a respected member of the business community has been found on some gray dawn somewhere in the suburbs, dancing on the embers of a cross, squeaking and gibbering in his sheet. It is, I think, a terrible thought. Like most thoughts concerning masks worn in the dark, it is almost too terrible for any thought. In the days when I wore a hood, I remember a fleeting fear that I was not so much protected from recognition by the law-abiding world as cut off by my very facelessness from the comforts of that world. Soaping the window was a gay occupation, but I remember also the intensity of that feeling of being outside looking in. And if the grown-up citizens in sheets who burnt the cross in Alabama last night are worth our study, and they are, I think the embryo emotions of Halloween are helpful references. I deduce that the man in a hood last night burning his cross and muttering his muffled oaths knew that outside feeling, the dark sense of standing in that featureless congregation utterly alone, outside of every righteous human law. On the wrong side of all the windows in the world. Of course, there was in Alabama last night the reassurance of ritual on that hill. There was such ritual in the secret societies convened in our ancestral caves. Jungle rituals, voodoo, mumbo-jumbo, black magic. It's no accident that the headman of the clan, the ruling Ku Kluxer, is called a wizard, and it is more than a casual matter that the central ceremonial of the KKK is the burning of the cross. This is a very old instinct indeed. The urge to blasphemy, that most antique, most antic sin, as old as sin itself, as old as any church, the profanation of the altar. The mad pagan Nazis crippled the cross and made it the trademark of their party. The hooded man in Alabama and his friends in the hooded hood set fire to the cross. And because men cannot escape the veracities of the symbols they choose, these men announced to the Alabama night their intention. And this is to burn up the teachings and examples of him whose anguish has made the cross a sign for the very passions of brotherhood. We've been concerned today with what goes on in the brain, in the head, in the hood. This is, to be sure, a very trifling concern indeed. What matters is what's going on in the heart of this nation when the KKK rides again and the cross is burned at night in the hills above our sleeping towns. When I wore a hood, I was afraid to wear the hood alone. I think the same thing goes for the man in Alabama who wore the hood last night and for his sheeted colleagues, wherever they are meeting in this land of the free. The way to fight these Ku Kluxers is not to unmask them. That's too easy. The trick is to separate them one from the other because they run in packs. Since they're so interested in segregation, let's segregate them. All right, I see my time's about up. Again, my thanks to the lady for her letter and my thanks to you for listening. Goodbye. Please let me come to call again this same time next week. Till then, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.